This is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. This summer's bushfire season is not over. With one more month left of summer, there's still a lot of hot weather to come. But reflecting on the fires that raged down the east coast of Australia, there are some lessons to be learned and questions to be asked. Like, how could we have been better prepared for this bushfire season, and what could we have done differently? Welcome to the final episode of our summer series on climate change with Peter Hannam. Joining us is Laura Chung, who is usually the Sydney Morning Herald's urban affairs reporter. But Laura has spent this summer reporting from the fire grounds around New South Wales. So Peter and Laura, welcome once again to Please Explain. Peter, when we decided to do a special six-part summer series about climate in early December, we had no idea what this summer was really going to turn out to be like. We have now gotten to the very end of January. And to be honest, it's been pretty hellish, hasn't it?
Yes, and I think probably we could do another month of these if we really wanted to.
Are we past the worst of this summer?
Well, look, it's another month or more, obviously, before summer ends. But there's big bushfires still going around Canberra, obviously, Victoria. And I think you'll see probably in the next few days in Tasmania, they'll flare up because there's a big heat wave coming through. So I think without substantial rain, the fire season really has quite a long way to go. And of course, one thing is the firefighting, but the recovery work, which is really going to take months and possibly years. So that's really at the starting point.
Peter, we have talked about this before in this series, but can you just give us a quick rundown again of your assessment of how prepared we were for this summer's extraordinary events?
The weather forecasts were pretty clear from, you know, the middle of last year that we were heading towards a bad fire season. So you have to ask, you know, look quite forensically at what sort of preparations there were. You know, everything from reducing the risk for key infrastructure. Now, one of the interesting parts, if you're in anywhere near a fire zone, the message is always coming out about individuals to prepare your house, get ready, have a plan written down in case the fires come, know what to do. But what's quite interesting and instructive in some ways is those same plans don't exist for large parts of the public assets. And this is a sort of maybe why people were surprised when there were so many sort of telecommunications or power interruptions in key parts. And also, when does the army step in, say? Or when do you get sort of traffic controls to get people out of areas you're evacuating? Those sort of things, in a way, the states should have had really on the shelf ready to pull off. And it looks like that, to a large degree, hasn't actually been set up, even though it's been really talked about for years.
Laura, there were some things that were done differently this time around than in any other fire season that we've had. And the thing that struck me was the very strong language from the emergency services from the very beginning, introducing the catastrophic fire warning level, telling people that when the fire is at a catastrophic level, your house is not able to be saved, you must leave. They used very strong language, which at the beginning of the fire season, a lot of people thought was a bit over the top. And those mass evacuations out of East Gippsland and the South Coast at the beginning looked like they might have been an overreaction. But in reality, when you look at the ferocity of these fires and the sheer number of hectares that were burned, the tragic death toll that we've had is actually a lot lower than it could have been, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So we've had 32 deaths nationally, and of course that's very, very tragic. But we compare that to the 2009 Black Saturday fires, and we saw 173 deaths in one day. And I think you're absolutely right. It's definitely about that messaging. As soon as the RFS were able to predict, you know, that 4 day or 5 day ahead of where we were, they were immediately saying, look, it's going to be a catastrophic day. If you don't need to be in the area, get out. And I think that really resonated with people and made them understand just how severe the conditions we were facing were, and at the end of the day really protected a lot of people's lives.
And I suppose one of the things that will be examined is it was obviously a good thing to get all those people out. The way that it was conducted was not perfect, and perhaps next time we order an enormous part of a coastal region to be evacuated over the next 48 hours, perhaps there might be some better planning and the ADF might be involved in those things. From your perspective, Laura, out on the fire grounds, what did work?
I think one thing that we have to acknowledge is the amazing effort of these volunteer firefighters and, of course, the paid firefighters as well. And no doubt this is going to come under review. There's been a lot of discussions of, you know, is the volunteer firefighter model sustainable? But one thing I noticed was there's a lot of frustration from these local volunteer firefighters who have been in the force for 20 years and they know the land around them so, so well. But they feel that, you know, the headquarters that are, you know, 3 hours away and looking after the local area aren't listening to their local knowledge. So when they say, let's do a backburn here, headquarters is responding in 3 or 4 hours when weather conditions have changed and it's no longer, you know, sustainable to do a backburn in the area. And they're saying, oh no, now we can't.
Is that a product of the centralisation of the Rural Fire Service?
I think it's definitely a product of it just takes so long for all these checklists and there's a lot of red tape to go through before you can get that okay to do a backburn. As Peter said, you know, we've seen cases of backburns just getting away. And I think, you know, there have been a lot of firefighters who have just decided that they've had it. They can't deal with this bureaucracy from the headquarters and are hanging up their helmets and they've been doing it for 20 years. And that's really sad to see that there is this feeling of, you know, what they say doesn't matter and that, you know, they feel that they can't represent their local community and can't protect it. And the best thing that they can do is hang up their hat and, you know, band together with a couple of friends and put their lives on the line to go out and kind of act in these mosquito army.
Oh, that's happening? There's like vigilante firefighting.
Absolutely.
Going on.
So you see people just driving down the road with water in a big tank and just zipping in and out of quite dangerous areas just to put out the fire because they feel that the RFS isn't getting into the right places.
You're listening to Please Explain. We'll be right back.
From the team that brought you Phoebe's Fall and Wrong Skin comes a new 10-part investigative podcast.
Motor, vessel, Pong, Sue, I intend to board you.
I thought to myself, this is this f***ing boat.
The Last Voyage of the Pong Sue is a story of drugs, cops, espionage, military, death, a dictator and mateship.
Flag of my honour is Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
150 kilos of heroin had never been imported before.
These people, they expected to be executed.
It's a dead person.
Holy shit.
Search for The Last Voyage of the Pong Sue on your favourite podcast app.
One of the things I've been curious about when you're talking about the disparity in level of quality and resources across the state, all of that money that's poured into the New South Wales Rural Fire Service and the Victorian Country Fire Association, a lot of that has gone to individual brigades. And then there's been this huge chunk that's gone in centrally. That money does not go to pay volunteers. What do they spend all that money on now that they've raised it all?
Well, they've got like increasingly, more aircraft. Maybe that's also a large chunk of that bill. But it's true that when we're out in different parts of the state, when you're speaking to volunteers, you know, they'll say, here's some breathing apparatus that we've bought for donations at the local level because it wasn't good enough what we were getting from the centre. And indeed, the public outpouring of support for the RFS and the other fire services in different parts of the country means that there's donations are flooding in at the local level. So how's that going to be coordinated and best spent? I'm not sure there's a lot of thought gone into that so far. But, you know, if you do get, say, poorer communities, because there's less money to be donated, getting sort of hand-me-down equipment, second or third-hand trucks, etc., you also maybe undermine the health and safety of those fire brigades that might well be expected to do the same thing when they're brought into a fire as fire brigades that are better equipped.
I think there's this really lovely scenario of this little fire brigade in Collavale in the Southern Highlands in New South Wales. And they were asking for money. They said, look, we've got enough food donations. We don't need any more food. But if you can give us money, that would be great, because they were tinkering away and making their own attachments that they'd put on hoses. So they were saying that they had this hose, but it wasn't effective to try and put out burning logs. You know, you put it right down the middle of the tree and it just kind of spurts out the other end. So instead, they'd invented this device that you were attached on the end of a hose, and you put the device in the tree and essentially, you know, smooshed it around, and it would eject retardant and water and essentially get into those really hard to reach parts of the log. and put out the fire in about half the time, and it would use about, you know, a third less water. And I think, you know, this isn't the only case of a local brigade tinkering away and making up their own devices, but that's a lot of where the funds go as well.
And so a lot of the expertise, rather than coming from the top down, should start flowing from the bottom up. Peter, without preempting the multitude of inquiries that are going to take place, what could the future look like for fire prevention and fighting in Australia if we get it right?
Okay, so if you take the climate science, for example, that southern Australia is drying out, and it's been going on for decades during the cool months, the winters, if you like. So that means that going into spring, which is often the fire season for instance, New South Wales, then you can expect probably demands on fire services will increase over time, and higher temperatures, you know, to boot. So you have to work out what's the likely requirements in terms of extra numbers. We've just seen firefighters, some of them been going for, you know, 2 or 3 months off and on, and that's a huge tax on their time and often on their income. So some way perhaps to have income support needs to be considered while maintaining that volunteer ethos. So that's one aspect. Another area that we've seen through the summer as it's unfolded, the impact on wildlife has been really severe. And a whole lot of government programs which were devoted to protecting individual threatened species now just burned away. So do you just start again looking after that particular frog or that particular glider or plant or so on? Or do you take a chance, now is the time to look at the whole ecosystem when you're designing on what resilience looks like from an environmental side. So you pay attention to all the pollinators and the predators and so on that you need, including, for instance, dingoes to keep the feral cats and foxes down. Keep those in mind when you're looking at how do you spend your next, you know, round of environmental dollars. So we'll be seeing those kind of programs rolling out in the near term, and we'll judge whether they are kind of future ready. But there's a whole lot of other things, including, for example, the building codes. So after the Black Saturday bushfires in Victoria, they raised the standard of requiring if you're in a fire zone. But it turns out that some of these buildings that were built to this 3959 code, in fact, didn't survive the radiation from these particular fires. So that's going to be have to looked at again. So you have to look at the building codes.
So just to be clear, these were codes that were introduced after Black Saturday, which proved to be inadequate this summer.
It appears so. So I'm getting feedback that some of these houses didn't meet, you know, they went up still. So all of these things are talking about, if you like, risk reduction rather than elimination. Unless you're living in like a hobbit hole in the ground, then probably, you know, you're going to have some risk. But it looks like the standard that was introduced in 2009 will have to be revisited and taking into account what we expect, you know, future temperatures and sort of fire intensity, fire weather. That will need to be changed. The last thing I'd mention this as well is the planning in terms of where do you have houses, how close to the bush. Are there some places which will be deemed can't be defended? And that so people live there, maybe they really love the amenity of the bush right next to them, but they have to realize that you know, even the best built house is really still going to be at risk. Do we want to have, say, the new housing estates being put in right up against, for instance, the catchment areas of Sydney and Melbourne? So you're right up against the bush. So is the answer when you move the houses in, you reduce, you know, push back the forest by a couple of, you know, kilometres? If you did that, then you can imagine the next round of planning would put those houses further in there too. So those are kinds of things where, and even to the point that maybe we have to buy some people out because they're living in, you know, too dangerous areas, are kinds of the questions which governments and local councils and so on are going to have to grapple with.
Mm. Laura, after your summer of covering this crisis, what are the lessons that you've seen that could impact our future behaviours?
I think this has probably been one of the most documented bushfires that we've ever seen. We've had, you know, thousands of hours of footage on social media of firefighters taking their own footage, of journalists taking videos and writing these stories. So I think from that, we're certainly going to learn a lot about fire behaviour, fire management, fire mapping, and how we prevent something like this happening again. Having said that, I definitely don't think this is the last we've seen of a horrific bushfire season. And I think at this stage, all we can really do is wait and see what these reviews bring.
Well, thank you to both of you, not just for today and the work you've done on the podcast, but also for just working so hard over the last 2 months to do pretty extraordinary coverage of this extraordinary crisis that we've had. Thanks for being on Please Explain.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to our Please Explain guests this week, Environment Editor Peter Hannam and Laura Chung, the Urban Affairs Reporter from the Sydney Morning Herald. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our newsrooms, so to support independent journalism, search Subscribe, the Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. If you've been enjoying this podcast, please leave us a ratings or review on iTunes. This episode of Please Explain was produced and edited by Leah Samoglu. Amelia Maguire manages logistics and planning, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.